because I wanted to deliver the message in person. I thought Eddie Denise had been improperly attacked by the press. He wasn't out to hurt Ted Kennedy. Denise had tried to save him. Kennedy said, "What's on your mind?" Smith was bothered about what went on during Chappaquiddick, he said. "I don't think you're getting information. You're surrounding yourself. Guys who tried to help couldn't reach you. And it's a shame you didn't get the message, because a lot of the mess could have been avoided." Kennedy dodged the bullet, Smith observed. He went right into the cover-up. "Ask me anything you want. I've answered everything," Kennedy said. "There's nothing more I can say. It's been fully covered." Kennedy was considering taking second place on a ticket headed by George McGovern, if that was the only way to beat Nixon. His advisor suggesting the cleansing effect that a vigorous progressive national campaign would have on the sour memory of Chappaquiddick. But if Kennedy were a candidate, he could expect Chappaquiddick to be brought up repeatedly. The Nixon White House had a file of information about the accident. "Nickel and dime stuff," Kennedy said. "They haven't come up with anything really new." Kennedy was urged to claim jurisdiction for his subcommittee on administrative practices and procedures over a burglary at Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate apartment and office complex. A Kennedy-chaired investigation of the break-in could make Watergate the biggest political television show since the McCarthy hearings, according to columnist Stuart Alsop. Kennedy hesitated to become involved in a political scandal coming so close upon his own. Watergate burglar E. Howard Hunt had spent time investigating Chappaquiddick. Under the alias Albert Patterson, Hunt had written the clerk of the Edgartown Superior Court on December 3, 1971, to inquire about the availability of several exhibits connected with the Kennedy-Kopechne inquest. Hunt was seeking a good, clear copy of scuba diver John Farrar's drawing of Mary Jo Kopechne underwater, and the operator's report of the accident Kennedy had filed with the Registry of Motor Vehicles. Patterson was referred to the district attorney's office at Barnstable Courthouse. A 3-month investigation undertaken in October 1972 by Kennedy's subcommittee behind closed doors disclosed findings sufficient to persuade the Democratic leadership to create a Senate Select Committee to hold hearings on Watergate. Nixon's men saw the fine Kennedy hand behind the inquiry, and discussed seeking FBI files to show improprieties had occurred during the Kennedy administration and in the obstruction of justice in the Chappaquiddick case. Kennedy kept a discreet distance from the burgeoning scandal. Not until September 1973 did Kennedy rise in the Senate to declare that if President Nixon defied a Supreme Court order to turn over tapes of Oval Office conferences with his staff, a responsible Congress would be left with no recourse but to exercise its power of impeachment. Until all the facts about Chappaquiddick were known, Kennedy was the last person in the country to lecture us on Watergate, Senator Barry Goldwater said. Even liberal political columnist Tom Wicker of the New York Times suggested that the question implicit in Kennedy's remarks was how the country would react to the man of Chappaquiddick leading an impeachment battle against the man of Watergate. Unlike other politicians, Senator Kennedy did not believe the Watergate scandal had expanded the problem of Chappaquiddick. Polls were reporting Kennedy the first choice for the 1976 nomination by a majority of Democrats, including Joseph and Gwen Kopechne. They harbored no bitterness toward Senator Kennedy about the accident. "We have only pleasant feelings for him. We wish him well," Joseph Kopechne said. While some aspects of the Chappaquiddick investigation could have been handled better, "It's all over now. These shocking, terrible accidents do happen," Kopechne said. No purpose would be accomplished by raising the issue again. Kennedy felt confident enough about the matter to return to Edgartown on January 19, 1973, to hold 3 days of meetings to hear local opinion about legislation he'd proposed to establish a national park of shorelands, including Chappaquiddick. Arena assigned a detail to protect the senator. "Not on account of Chappaquiddick, but because we thought they were going to hang him. The national park proposal was a very unpopular idea." Under the Kennedy plan, half of the island's land area would be removed from the control of local officials. Kennedy had observed the ineffectiveness of local zoning boards in serving as a barrier to the almighty developer. Kennedy clashed with his friend and biggest supporter, Robert Carroll, co-chairman of the Islands Action Committee, opposed to the bill. With operatives spreading the word, Ted Kennedy was definitely running for president in 1976. A climate of gloom was enveloping those in the Democratic Party, who believed the stain of Chappaquiddick would defeat Kennedy in a general election. Appearing on Face the Nation on March 14, 1974, Kennedy denied the incident would have any bearing on his political future. "There's a full response, and the inquest has been made public," he said. "And I would expect that people are going to have to make a judgment out of it. And I'm prepared to go to the people, were I a candidate, and be judged." Kennedy's supporters were convinced Watergate had obscured the public memory of Chappaquiddick, and that the ghost of Miss Kopechne will not again be raised in a serious way. With Kennedy's candidacy all but declared, the fifth anniversary of Chappaquiddick brought a flood of retrospectives about the accident. The most devastating was a replication of the case as a multi-layered, complex mystery that remains as baffling today as it was 5 years ago, by Robert Sherrill, Washington correspondent for The Nation. Sherrill provided a case study of how a famous politician, by delays, by obfuscation, by propaganda, by all kinds of tricks and wiles, can kill somebody under mysterious circumstances and still regularly receive more than 40% of the support in presidential preference polls. On July 30, 1974, three articles of impeachment voted by the House Judiciary Committee charged President Nixon with having obstructed and impeded the administration of justice in order to cover up unlawful activities, withheld material evidence and information, and caused false and misleading statements to be made to lawfully authorized investigative officers and judicial proceedings. Charges critics had unofficially made about Chappaquiddick. Cries were again heard for the same kind of disclosures about the accident from Kennedy, as were being demanded of Nixon about Watergate. There was no chance of the Chappaquiddick case being reopened and given a Watergate-style going over, Massachusetts Attorney General Robert Quinn said. Kennedy's press secretary pointed out 125 to 200 of the nation's best reporters had looked into Chappaquiddick and have found nothing beyond the record. But a symbolic connection between the two scandals was forged after Nixon resigned on August 8th and retained Herbert Jack Miller as his criminal attorney. Miller had played a key role in defending Ted Kennedy in the Chappaquiddick case. Now he was employed to perform the same task for the fallen president. And that Miller did brilliantly. After conferring with Nixon at the compound in San Clemente, Miller met with Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski. Should evidence of an investigation point to criminal conduct, an indictment would be sought against the former president on the likely charge of conspiracy to obstruct justice. In a memorandum of law he submitted to Jaworski, Miller echoed Edward Hanafy's brief on Senator Kennedy's appeal before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, arguing that intense publicity about Watergate made it inconceivable that a jury free from actual bias could be found. Nixon's constitutional rights of due process would be seriously threatened by prosecution. Like Hanafy, Miller cited the Shepard murder case as an example, where pre-trial publicity had subverted a fair trial. 2 days of intense negotiations produced an agreement for the turnover of White House tapes and other documents to the General Services Administration, in exchange for a full presidential pardon. Secure in the knowledge his own cover-up was of a more enduring nature, Kennedy scorned the preferential judicial treatment his former attorney had negotiated on Nixon's behalf. "Do we operate under a system of equal justice under the law? Or is there one system of justice for the average citizen and another for the high and mighty?" Kennedy thundered in the Senate. But his moral posture had been made crooked by Chappaquiddick. Kennedy denied any relationship between the two episodes. I think there may be some people who draw that kind of parallel. But of course, Chappaquiddick is an entirely different situation, he said. Watergate was an attempt to corrupt the political processes and to violate basic constitutional rights and liberties of individuals in a premeditated and deliberate way. The other was a tragic accident. Chapter 56. Mary Jo Kopechne was not the only casualty of that tragic accident. To some, Chappaquiddick had a decisive impact on the Nixon presidency, too. First, there was, in the Nixon White House, euphoria at the prospect of not having to face Kennedy for re-election. But that euphoria had hardened into an atmosphere of spite and vendetta, Dan Rather observed in the Palace Guard. It may be said that Chappaquiddick helped unleash the forces that in time would make a wreckage of Richard Nixon's presidency. It also made a wreckage of Kennedy's presidential hopes. His second chance at the White House since Chappaquiddick was swamped in the wake of Watergate. Citing family responsibilities, Kennedy announced on September 23, 1974, his firm, final, and unconditional decision not to seek the presidency in 1976. Kennedy denied Chappaquiddick was what drove him from running. He said, "I can live with my testimony." The trouble was, few others could. Had Kennedy sought the nomination, his most obvious problem is Chappaquiddick and the still unexplained discrepancies between his story and what seems to be indisputable facts, McCall's observed in November 1974. Chappaquiddick would have neutralized Watergate as a Democratic attack weapon. The lingering doubts about the accident had threatened a bitter, nasty mudslinging campaign. Already battle lines were being drawn. Bumper stickers had appeared to proclaim, "Nobody drowned at Watergate." In anticipation of a Kennedy candidacy in 1976, the Boston Globe had undertaken an ambitious reinvestigation of the accident over the summer of 1974. "We are not out to drive Ted Kennedy from office," editor Tom Winship explained. "We are trying to get more details on an important story affecting a public figure who will continue to be important." Senator Kennedy granted a 2-hour interview to a team of investigative reporters to discuss the accident for the first time since the inquest. He continued to insist his version of the accident was accurate. The widespread skepticism about his inquest testimony was unwarranted and unjustified, he said. "I attempted, during the course of the inquest, to respond to these questions completely, candidly, honestly, and to the best of my ability." His conduct had been irrational and indefensible and inexcusable and inexplicable. He said, "I was, at that time, obsessed by grief at the loss of a life. It was strictly a state of mind." But Kennedy cleared up none of the contradictions involved in the accident or the nearly 100 discrepancies in the testimony and statements by several key inquest witnesses. Preferential treatment by law enforcement and judicial officials had saved Kennedy from being charged with serious crimes, including manslaughter, the Globe concluded in its 4-part series. Routine investigative and judicial procedures had been either altered or botched numerous times by apprehensive officials in overwhelming deference to Kennedy's power and prestige. Justice was not served, hard questions were not asked of witnesses, and complaints and indictments not pursued. Kennedy protested the Globe's use of unnamed sources to give prominence to charges that were ugly, untrue, and grossly unfair. He said, "It is regrettable, in the atmosphere of doubt and suspicion, which enshrouds us as a people, that the truth cannot compete with the unnamed source, the groundless suggestion and speculation, which is nurtured by articles of sensationalism. The facts, as Kennedy related them, are harsh, complete and cold on their own, and no alteration of them to satisfy new suspicions could relieve me from the remorse and regret of which they constantly remind me." Kennedy attributed renewed interest in the accident to a post-Watergate mentality, rather than any questions about the accident. "The problem is, they haven't been answered the way the writers would like to have them answered," he said. "The real story has been told. They're not going to find other kinds of facts, because they just don't exist. The unanswered questions about Chappaquiddick had left Gwen Kopechne angry and frustrated. "Sometimes I'd like to scream a lot, but I'm trying to hold it back," she said. "It would be nice if somebody would speak up." Senator Kennedy had called her about the Globe articles. He was worried that I might read some of it and become upset. The Kopechnes came to Edgartown in June 1975 to seek answers to the case for themselves. Crossing on the ferry to Chappaquiddick, Gwen Kopechne pointed out the public telephone in the ferry house at the landing. Joseph Kopechne said, "I was rather afraid what her reaction would be when we went up to Dyke Bridge. In fact, she reminded me of what part of the bridge the car went over. I had clean forgotten." Among those they tracked down was Huck Look. Resigned to having his story questioned, Look said, "It just becomes, as I told everybody, a thing of credibility. If you want to believe him, fine. If you want to believe me, I've got nothing to gain in any way, shape, or form." Evidently, Edgartown believed Look. They'd elected him sheriff. Look would never live long enough to believe he hadn't seen Ted Kennedy's car going down Dyke Road an hour and a half after the senator said the car went off Dyke Bridge. "He's so sure of what he saw that it makes me think better about what really might have happened," Joseph Kopechne said. "It looks to me like there's a lot of unanswered questions now that I look at it objectively. The senator gave me the story. I believed it. It's possible," Mrs. Kopechne said. "But at the same time, I didn't have any questions to ask him. I was only listening to anybody that was saying anything to me. Now I think I would give a little argument. Now I'd have something to say." The Kopechnes hesitated before entering the turf and tackle shop to talk to John Farrar. After all the inconsistencies and evasions, Farrar was more convinced than ever the truth had not come out. Mary Jo Kopechne could have been saved if rescue personnel and equipment had been immediately called to the accident scene, he said. "I know she suffocated when her oxygen ran out. She didn't drown." "I felt that boy is experienced enough so that he can make those statements. He convinced me real good," Mrs. Kopechne told Gerald Kelly, a local freelance journalist. She added, "No matter how you look at it, it was an accident. What hurts me deep is to think that my daughter had to be left there all night. This is why we hold so bitter a feeling towards Markham and Gargan. I think Kennedy made his statement when he was still confused. In the state he was in, I do believe he couldn't think clearly. I think he was taking all this bad advice, and it just continued for days. He got so deeply involved in it he couldn't back out and tell the truth. How is he going to change his story and get out of it? Now he's in worse trouble than he would have been if he had come out and given the story himself without anybody advising him." Mrs. Kopechne wanted to talk to someone who had attended the party at Chappaquiddick. "I'd like to know what went on, what they were doing, what led up to Mary Jo leaving, and what happened afterward," she said. "I'm still waiting for something to happen. If you wait long enough, you get what you're waiting for. That one day, I'll know everything I want to know. I don't want to hurt anybody. I think even the senator has got enough problems." The Kopechne stayed at the Katama Shores Motel where their daughter had been lodged during the regatta weekend. The bathroom wallpaper had fish floating through clouds of seaweed, Mrs. Kopechne said. Her daughter's death was with her. "Every time I entered that bathroom last night, it is with me every time I take a bath." Chappaquiddick continued to hurt the senator politically, but it did not affect his re-election to the Senate in 1976. A request for security personnel made through the state police got Bernie Flynn assigned as Senator Kennedy's bodyguard for a campaign fundraising party at Paden Aram, a suburb of New Bedford. Told to mingle inconspicuously with guests, Flynn engaged Jack Crimmins in conversation and disclosed he'd been an investigator for the district attorney's office on the Chappaquiddick case. "I'm the guy that helped the senator out," Flynn said. "I'm the one that told Stephen Smith about inquest evidence." Flynn observed Crimmins in conversation with Senator Kennedy a short time later. He was standing like 10 feet away. I just happened to turn around at the right moment to catch Crimmins whispering in his ear. Kennedy was looking right at me with this startled look on his face. So I guess Crimmins told him who I was. After the political affair, Kennedy invited Flynn to a private steak and lobster dinner in Plymouth, hosted by Jack Campbell, a longtime supporter and owner of radio station WPLM. Campbell memorialized the occasion by taking photographs. Flynn wanted to have his picture taken with the senator. Kennedy was happy to oblige his Chappaquiddick benefactor. Kennedy won re-election, but the beneficiary of Watergate was Jimmy Carter. Outraged that a restoration should have been usurped by a political upstart from Georgia, Kennedy supporters revived rumors of a possible candidacy in 1980. Returning to Edgartown again in 1978, the Kopechnys threatened to go on national television and ruin Kennedy if he tried to run for president. But by 1979, they had changed their mind. They still didn't know the full story of the accident, but saw no reason to bring everything up again. Gwen Kopechne said, "Everyone makes mistakes. If he runs, we won't interfere." Kennedy telephoned the Kopechnys to express regret for another avalanche of publicity as the 10th anniversary of Chappaquiddick approached. In fact, much of the publicity could have been avoided had Kennedy himself not granted numerous interviews, motivated by a desire to put the issue to rest before the campaign. Kennedy was now inviting reporters to ask him any questions they wanted about Chappaquiddick. "Because I will answer them, as I have answered them in the past." The answers seemed almost memorized, the Washington Post complained. An interview with the senator about Chappaquiddick was a distinctly unenlightening exercise, frequently punctuated by denials before the questions are complete. Sometimes Kennedy tries to fob off questions by alluding to what he said at the inquest. Occasionally, he has to be reminded that he was never asked the question. On the eve of the 10th anniversary of the accident, the senator called the long-promised press conference to answer questions about the accident the inquest had left unanswered. "Many of the actions that I was involved in on that night were irresponsible," Kennedy said. But he did not believe Chappaquiddick posed the kind of tests he had met for 17 years in the Senate and would face as president. Kennedy had confronted issues of war and peace in public life since the accident. "And I felt no hesitancy about involving myself in them and taking stands on many of them." Kennedy hadn't been asked a new question about Chappaquiddick in 10 years, he said. "There hasn't been a new fact that has questioned the position that I stated at the time of the tragedy, and there cannot be." No information would ever challenge his sworn testimony, because it doesn't exist. Chief Arena shared that view. "In the 10 years since the accident, no one has ever found anything to support more than what I initially charged him with." Still, one question continued to intrigue Arena. What had gone on from the time of the accident and Kennedy's report the next morning? "Expanding on it might lead to something that is beneficial to him, or it might not," he said. Arena wasn't sure he could vote for Kennedy if he ran for president. "I certainly couldn't wipe Chappaquiddick out of my mind. If Kennedy was a candidate, an investigation should be reopened and every facet of the accident re-examined," Arena said. "I still think the whole case deserves scrutiny." Senator Kennedy had cooperated fully and completely with all of the law enforcement agencies involved, his press secretary replied. "What does Chief Arena want to be done?" But Arena's doubts about a presidential candidacy were shared by others. "I don't think anybody can forget Chappaquiddick," Republican Congresswoman Millicent Fenwick told McCall's. Asked if there was any other issue besides Chappaquiddick that would defeat Senator Kennedy if he ran for president, Republican candidate Ronald Reagan replied, "Well, you mentioned one pretty good one." Historian and former White House advisor Arthur Schlesinger Jr. doubted Chappaquiddick would be a decisive factor in a presidential campaign. Ever since the accident, Kennedy had been trying to redeem himself for those hours of panic. "He has become ever more serious, more senatorial, more devoted to the public good," Schlesinger said. I think this ceaseless effort at self-redemption may be for Teddy Kennedy what polio was for FDR. By June 1979, Kennedy was leading President Carter better than 2-1 in public opinion polls. Twice as many Democrats had unfavorable ratings for the president as for Ted Kennedy. All signs were pointing to Kennedy positioning himself for the run. But Kennedy was adamant. He was not running, he said. As I've said many times, I expect the president to be renominated, and I expect to support him. Carter dismissed opinion polls as an accurate gauge of presidential popularity. We've had some crises where it required a steady hand, a careful and deliberate decision to be made, he said. I don't think I panicked in the crises. An observation regarded as a coded reference to the senator's failure to report his accident for 10 hours. Kennedy did not expect Carter to bring up Chappaquiddick in the election, should he decide to seek the nomination, he said. I think the president wants to talk about issues that are important to the country. But the senator got a foretaste of what he could expect as a presidential candidate at a political rally in Louisville, confronted by placards bearing Mary Jo Kopechne's name and the effigy of a female corpse. In the face of continued questions about Chappaquiddick, Kennedy said, "People may not believe me or accept some of my answers, but the idea that the people who were there that night are holding back some secret is just all wrong." Repeated efforts by the New York Times to persuade Kennedy's friends to discuss the period after the accident were fruitless. They refused, as they have for 10 years, to clarify the sequence of events on a night still cloaked in mystery. Kennedy denied forbidding anyone to talk to the press. "Some have chosen to engage in interviews and conversation, others have not," he said. "I left that completely up to their discretion." However, Kennedy still had a lawyer-client relationship with those who had given him legal advice after the accident. He did not want Joe Gargan or Paul Markham talking to reporters. On Meet the Press, he continued to insist, "There is not going to be any new information that is going to challenge my testimony. If there was, there would be absolutely no reason that I should consider remaining in public office, let alone run for presidency of the United States." Chappaquiddick had not figured at all in Kennedy's decision to seek the nomination, Stephen Smith reported. The only major negative, as always, was the assassination fear. But the judgment of everyone in the end was that you can't let that rule your life forever. Kennedy had made known. His family was ready, if he was. Chapter 57. But Kennedy was apparently not so ready as he thought. On September 29, 1979, Roger Mudd of CBS News arrived in Hyannisport to conduct an interview. Mudd tossed out a question he expected the senator to hit out of the ballpark. "Do you think, Senator, that anybody really will ever fully believe your explanation of Chappaquiddick?" Kennedy struck out. He had found his behavior beyond belief himself, he said. Aired as part of a one-hour documentary special, Mudd devoted half the broadcast to the accident, asked Kennedy about other women in his life, and characterized his marriage as existing only on select occasions. In an atmosphere of euphoria and great expectations, Kennedy formally announced his candidacy on November 7th at Faneuil Hall. But the promise of that candidacy, heralded since 1968, proved to be more seductive than the candidacy itself. Kennedy's campaign disintegrated a month later. Chappaquiddick was partly responsible for the dramatic plunge in Kennedy's popularity in opinion polls. Doubts about the propriety of Kennedy's behavior at Chappaquiddick have risen significantly in the 6 months since polls the previous spring showed most Americans willing to forgive and forget the incident. Kennedy was having trouble attracting support from politically active women. Feminist Betty Friedan still felt queasy about Chappaquiddick, she said. By the following January, Kennedy's advisors were preoccupied with the impact Chappaquiddick was having on the campaign. The issue had been seriously misjudged. Kennedy had allowed himself to be misled by pollsters, friends, and advisors into believing Chappaquiddick had faded as a potential source of trouble. Campaign manager Stephen Smith called a press conference to refute a Washington Star report questioning Kennedy's claim to have nearly drowned swimming the channel after the accident. Hitherto undiscovered evidence relating to tides and topography placed a crucial element of his story in doubt. Aerial photographs taken on May 15, 1969, had revealed the Ketama opening had sealed off, making Chappaquiddick not an island separate from Edgartown. A rising tide no longer flowed out of the harbor, but in a reverse direction from that which Kennedy described in his inquest testimony. To challenge the story, Smith brought two admiralty lawyers and an ocean engineer to the press conference, the same team of experts that accompanied Kennedy to a second conference the next day. Kennedy characterized the articles as inaccurate, irresponsible, and incomplete, and charged the newspaper had misrepresented what it had been told by tidal experts. Edgartown harbormaster Robert Morgan speculated, "The tide that night could not have been other than what Mr. Kennedy testified." Morgan had taken a sailboat under tow to a pier close to the ferry landing shortly before midnight on July 18th, he said. The tide was low and quite slack, not moving in either direction, a condition that meant within the next 30 minutes to an hour, the tide would be running strongly out of the harbor. The integrity of the entire Edgartown community was being seriously questioned by a barrage of national press stories about the accident, the Vineyard Gazette complained. When the New York Times questioned editorially whether Senator Kennedy had used his enormous influence to protect himself and his career by leading a cover-up of misconduct, readers would be led to believe investigative and prosecution officials on Martha's Vineyard had been negligent, inept, or subjected to influence, the Gazette observed. The clearly documented facts are that the tragedy was investigated by honest, competent police officers before it became known Kennedy was the driver of the car, and no basis was found for a complaint of speeding or reckless driving. The conduct of the entire case by Judge Boyle was legally precise and impartial. One will go far in legal annals to find an abler judicial exercise. Denouncing an article in Reader's Digest as a very serious misrepresentation of the operation of the automobile before the accident, Stephen Smith pointed out Senator Kennedy's rate of speed had been officially accepted by a Registry of Motor Vehicles investigation. An accident analysis hired by the Digest to recreate conditions by computer revealed Kennedy had been driving on the wrong side of Dyke Road, going approximately 34 miles per hour at the time of the accident. Kennedy had slammed on the brakes when he saw the bridge, skidded 17 feet along the road, another 25 feet up the bridge, and jumped the rub rail. Despite his braking effort, the car had been traveling between 20 to 22 miles an hour when it hurtled 35 feet over Poca Pond. That the Registry of Motor Vehicles had refused to release to the Digest a copy of its report of the accident, without written notarized authorization from Senator Kennedy himself, came as a surprise to Ronald Andrews, a private investigator specializing in laws pertaining to public records. He said, "I knew that according to Massachusetts law, anyone was able to gain access to the report." Andrews' request for a copy of the report was refused because the document was protected under the Fair Information Practices Act. Registry Counsel Rico Matera explained later, "The invasion of personal privacy in many instances outweighs the public's right to know, for the pertinent facts in this case have been spewed out to the public by the news media for many, many years." Andrews appealed to the Supervisor of Public Records of the Department of the Secretary of State. Registrar McLaughlin was informed that a fatal accident report was not exempt from disclosure exceptions, and directed him to provide Andrews a copy of the report. Most interested to discover that Senator Kennedy's license had been thought for a time to have expired, Andrews turned the report over to Ralph Gordon, a veteran court reporter for the Springfield Newspapers Bureau in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Gordon started checking up the story. Registry Inspector John Molino told him, "I never liked all this cover-up stuff going on." Molino dismissed the idea a license renewal could be left in the tab room for 5 months. Inspector Herb Burr couldn't explain the delay either, he said.
I have nothing to say about that.
Gordon was surprised to receive a call from Registrar McLaughlin himself.
I understand you've been talking to some of my men about Chappaquiddick, he said.
McLaughlin had the Chappaquiddick file in front of him, he said. The registry was the only agency that went straight down the line on the case. Kennedy's license had been revoked on July 20th, 1969, and surrendered to him personally by his lawyer, Judge Robert Clark. Asked to explain the 5-month delay in Kennedy's renewal card being replaced in the registry's files, McLaughlin grew impatient.
You're insinuating something that doesn't exist, and ascribing it to the 11-year-old memory of an inexperienced man working in the radio room.
When Gordon emphasized he was reading from Inspector George Kennedy's report, McLaughlin hung up. His office was not accepting any calls from you, Gordon was told when he tried to reach the registrar again. Gordon wrote the story and sent it to Springfield.
Beyond that, I didn't hear a thing, until I realized they weren't going to print it, Gordon recalled.
I finally called to ask why. They didn't question the story. The response was, well, we just thought there had been enough on Chappaquiddick. They were supporting Kennedy and decided, as a political thing, not to use it.
But Kennedy's campaign was haunted by Chappaquiddick. Spectators in Chicago spit on the candidate and called him killer as he went down State Street in a parade. A retired doctor carried a sign, "Do you want the coward of Chappaquiddick for president?" outside a senior citizen center Kennedy visited. Kara Kennedy, the senator's 19-year-old daughter, was told, "Your father killed a young girl about your age."
Negative feelings toward Kennedy are growing each month, the Washington Post reported in March. Nearly half the Democrats nationwide had unfavorable views of him, reversing polls conducted in November. The issue of the campaign had devolved upon the central mystery of Chappaquiddick and the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Last year, Kennedy decided he could be invulnerable even to this. He was wrong. Voters have not forgiven that he got away with it in 1969 and thought he could get away with it again in 1980. Bernie Flynn, the man who bent the rules to aid Kennedy at the inquest, had also had a change of heart about the senator. When Kennedy ran against Carter and he was screeching and yelling, I said to myself, Christ, this man doesn't deserve to be president. I lost a lot of esteem for him. Flynn had had no contact with the senator since his security duty in 1976, and none whatever with Stephen Smith or Herbert Miller since their meeting at Logan Airport a week before the inquest. Flynn had not found it necessary to cash in his job insurance policy. If I was ambitious, and they were deciding on 2 different occasions to make U.S. Marshals, I would have called up Stephen Smith to say, "Now it's your turn to do me a favor," he said. But it didn't cross my mind to see how far Kennedy would reciprocate. After 32 years in law enforcement, Flynn had had enough. He retired from the state police in 1980. Stricken with cancer, George Killen had retired in 1975. 2 months before his death in 1979, Killen was still lamenting Chappaquiddick as the biggest mistake I ever made as a police officer. With the benefit of hindsight, Killen had dispensed with alternative theories and improbable scenarios to conclude Senator Kennedy had been drunk, in flight from Huck Look to avoid arrest, and probably speeding at the time of the accident. His recklessness responsible for the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Chappaquiddick was equally fatal to Kennedy's presidential aspirations in 1980. The senator made a spectacular appearance at the Democratic National Convention on August 12th, in a moment of defeat unprecedented for his family, to declare, "The dream shall never die." But his campaign had been a long struggle to overcome the stigma of Chappaquiddick. The senator told interviewer after interviewer that there was nothing new to say about the accident. Neither the public nor the press was persuaded, the New York Times said. In his pursuit of the presidential nomination, Kennedy had run against Chappaquiddick,
and Chappaquiddick had won. So decisive a defeat was regarded merely as a rehearsal for 1984 by some of Kennedy's supporters. Conventional political wisdom held that Kennedy would not again have to face the specter of the accident. A personal issue that's a problem in one campaign doesn't come back in the next, ran the argument. By July 1982, polls were reporting Kennedy the leading candidate for the presidential nomination in 1984. Seeking Senate re-election in Massachusetts against a millionaire businessman, Ray Shamey, hardly necessitated the expenditure of $2.5 million, three times what Kennedy had spent in 1976. Kennedy hoped to use the 1982 election as a laboratory to test ways to defuse the Chappaquiddick issue that had disabled his 1980 presidential campaign. So this is partly a test run for the 1984 presidential sweepstakes, the Wall Street Journal predicted, and to salvage some of the fabled political pride of the Kennedys. But door-to-door polling revealed the character issue a bigger factor than in 1976. Kennedy launched a television advertising campaign created by a California media consultant, which concentrated on his compassionate side. He needed just such image burnishing. A 40-page comic book sent to 2 million Massachusetts households by citizens organized to replace Kennedy portrayed him as a chubby black sheep and zeroed in on his history of cheating at Harvard, Virginia traffic violations, and Chappaquiddick. Kennedy's press secretary denounced the publication as the lowest level of propaganda. I find it appalling and hateful. The funny thing about it was, it's all true, Gargan said. Working on the campaign as usual, Gargan was taken to task for sitting on your ass all winter doing nothing by Ted Kennedy. Having joined Alcoholics Anonymous, involved in a courageous struggle to put his life back together, Gargan exploded. I've given you 30 years of my life, and what do I have to show for it? I'm a fool in the eyes of my own children because of Chappaquiddick. And that's your problem, not mine. One day, Gargan wanted the real story of the accident to be told. Gargan stormed out of the campaign and resisted all overtures to return. A fixture for years as advance man, Gargan's absence was too conspicuous not to be accounted for. Kennedy's office explained the senator's gradual drift from close friends such as Cousin Joe Gargan, with whom he has clashed on the sensitive issue of abortion. Despite the huge expenditure of campaign money, Kennedy ran less well than in 1976. The outlook for a presidential candidacy was not as promising as his advisors hoped. Exit polls of the 1.2 million who voted for him indicated over half wouldn't support him for president. If Kennedy believed some kind of a magical TV spot could neutralize Chappaquiddick and the kind of sustained barrage about it he would face in another presidential campaign, he was mistaken. Polls conducted in New Hampshire, exposed to the character ads on Boston television, indicated they had failed to reduce the hostility felt by a large number of voters. The idea that Chappaquiddick would fade over time had not proven to be true. Kennedy was in the strongest position of any candidate to gain the 1984 nomination. But given the negative feelings about him, he would be pursuing a smaller pool of voters. He could win, but it would be another long season of personal harangues and lurid press for him. One advisor suggested outgrowing Chappaquiddick by 1988 and the years beyond, when voters might treat a man in his late 50s more kindly for the indiscretions of his 30s. Citing family responsibilities and his decision to divorce his wife, Kennedy announced he wouldn't be a candidate or accept a draft for the nomination in 1984. He didn't rule out a future presidential campaign. I don't think it's any mystery that I would like to be president, he said. Kennedy denied he had withdrawn because of public doubts about his character, stemming mostly from Chappaquiddick. But an aide confirmed the senator had feared the impact on his children of another round of accusations and inquiries about his role in the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. For the first time in 24 years, a Kennedy was not a figure to be reckoned with at a Democratic National Convention. Disappointed not to have been chosen as keynote speaker,
Kennedy made a gas bag of a speech and appeared incapable of seriousness on the rostrum, laughing out loud at the traditional words of nomination. Events would prove Kennedy lucky to have withdrawn from presidential contention early. In August 1983, Robert Kennedy Jr. was arrested for possession of a gram of heroin. Revelations of drug use by a younger generation of Kennedys culminated in April 1984 in the death of David Kennedy from an overdose of cocaine, prescription painkillers, and tranquilizers at a hotel in Palm Beach. Senator Kennedy telephoned authorities to request the body of his nephew be removed so the investigation could be conducted in a less public setting. But this was Florida, not Massachusetts. Efforts to suppress information about the case didn't work. A court suit filed by a trio of newspapers sprung impounded records that revealed Caroline Kennedy to have visited the hotel 90 minutes before the body was discovered. Traces of drugs found in the room's toilet suggested efforts had been made to dispose of incriminating evidence. A pure assumption, Herbert Miller said. Miller, the shadow counselor of Chappaquiddick, was identified as a Washington lawyer who represented the Kennedy family. A Miller-prepared statement over Caroline Kennedy's name, denying she had entered the hotel room, was released through Senator Kennedy's Washington office. Kennedy kept a low profile until after the elections. In December 1984, Kennedy made a highly publicized trip to Ethiopia to investigate famine conditions, then to South Africa on a fact-finding mission to study the racial problems of apartheid. Accused of interfering in South Africa's internal affairs and exploiting a campaign-style barnstorming tour to launch his candidacy for the presidency in 1988, the Financial Times put Kennedy on its cover with the headline, "He's teaching us morals?" An editorial inside recalled the accident at Chappaquiddick, in which a young woman had died in his car. Kennedy was seriously considering running for president, an aide confirmed. "He's going to make a decision sometime in the second half of 1985. Kennedy had made it clear, "I want very much to be president. I know I can make a difference." By July 1985, Kennedy was leading all presidential preference polls. He still must overcome the 16-year shadow of Chappaquiddick, but it was thought he had turned his negatives around. The character issue would rise again, but the saliency of Chappaquiddick had diminished since 1979 in the view of advisers. The senator had reached a point where enough people will take a look at him on the basis of his record and values to elect him, the New Republic reported. Kennedy's staff had been instructed to assume there will be a presidential campaign and prepare for it. But a Boston Globe survey of Democratic state chairmen offered little encouragement to a Kennedy candidacy. One chairman observed, "The Chappaquiddick situation will just kill him as far as ever being elected president. You just hear it on the street. People still remember." Any mention of a Kennedy candidacy was sufficient to evoke the issue. Despite his lead in the polls, a Kennedy candidacy would be suicidal. Kennedy could expect some guy in a frogman outfit carrying a sign at every political rally. Opponents needed only to point out they were too high-minded to raise the Chappaquiddick issue, central to the judgment of a man's character, though it may be, to devastate his candidacy. For the first time, Kennedy would have to give up his Senate seat to seek the presidency. A loss would mean oblivion. On December 19, 1985, Kennedy produced a video and purchased time on two Boston television stations to announce his intention not to run for president in 1988. A grave Kennedy addressed the camera in a manner reminiscent of his Chappaquiddick speech to announce, "I know that this decision means that I may never be president, but the pursuit of the presidency is not my life. Public service is." For 16 years, the ghost of Chappaquiddick had hovered over his career, resisting all efforts to persuade the public that the real story had been told. Lodged in the nation's memory, the legacy of Chappaquiddick had concretized into a monument beneath which Kennedy was burying his presidential hopes.
No historian, but a poet, could inscribe the epitaph for the death of the Kennedy dream.
Chappaquiddick, Chappaquiddick, your syllables echo the sea. Your rhythm caught the vulnerable note, shattered the walls of a dynasty.
This concludes the reading of Chappaquiddick, Power, Privilege, and the Ted Kennedy Cover-Up by Leo DeMore. Copyright 1988 by Leo DeMore. Forward copyright 2018 by Howie Carr. This book was read by Peter Burkrot. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Regnery Gateway and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.